The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or to view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
I have two sets of handouts. If you don't get a copy, it's all on web. Okay? And if I do this well, every time you should get a handout. And my objective is for you to focus on listening and discussion, not to take notes. So it's either a handout or you go, it's online. Okay. It's an experimental course, the first time I'm offering it. So it has a special, say, 2997 number, 6 units. If you look at the handout, if you printed it yesterday, I changed something, and one of the changes is very important. This course will be pass-fail basis, okay? And what does it mean is, if you are an undergraduate student, for example, in course 2, pass-fail could count for unrestricted elective, but it does not count for restricted elective. And if you are course 2A, it does not count for your concentration. And if you're a graduate student, this is not an H-level course. It's not an H-level course. So those are the, just for your clarification. And if you look at the handout, the syllabus, what we will have, first is once a week at this time. And also, I have office hour. And I have a volunteer, TA, Daniel is here. You can contact him if you have questions. If necessary, we'll ask Daniel also to set up an office hour. And what else? I don't have a copy in my hand. Hello. Thank you. In terms of the requirement, homework, the homework is every week I will assign one reading, and you will turn in your report, one page summary of the reading. You can summarize what you understand, what you do not understand, and that's the, I do not say we're given extra number of homeworks, so it's a reading-based homework. And at the end of the semester, you will write a final report, project report, and the detail of the report will launch in the middle of the semester. Any questions? Okay. If not, I will start, like I said, all the... everything is online, and you can jot down whatever notes you want, but my purpose is not to have you write too much and focus on this. I do not have a textbook on this. So let me start. So this course, if you look at the title, is a direct solar thermal to electrical energy conversion technologies. There are a few points I want to emphasize. One is a heat-based course. Solar, thermal, this is all focused on the thermal aspect. The solar energy is, in this course, is a big, giant heat source. And the other aspect important in this course is a direct energy conversion. So the focus is how to convert the heat into electricity directly without the moving parts. And when I say the technology, realize that we move on. Those technologies, some already existing, but clearly is not widely spread used, right? It's not widely used. So they are still under development, and whether it will work out or not down the road is not completely sure, but say that's your opportunities. You're here to do research, future development, and maybe you will push some of this technology to the real world. So I will start with this slide to make a case that it's important that we think about the heat. You can start either from the input side, look at how we are using all the energy. Fossil fuel or even nuclear, the energy source, from the energy source to convert this energy into electricity, into mechanical energy, you can see more than 90% is via heat, right? The mostly is a thermal mechanical means to convert the energy into either mechanical energy or electric energy. And the other aspect is look at the end use, how much energy is lost, right? And you count all the numbers there, you'll find out that more than 60 to 70% of the energy are wasted. So what we are looking into is whether we can develop alternative ways to either use the input energy or convert some of the waste energy into electricity. Yes? Ten percent missing. You have to look at some of this end here. Okay. We're talking about the heat sources. So just a few examples. If you look at the automobile, the driver efficiency, as amazingly, is less than 20%. Right. And if you want to remember, it's easy to say about 1/3 of the energy goes through the tailpipe, exhaust. The other third roughly goes to the radiator, right? Those are completely wasted. So can we recover some of this energy? And in fact, this is challenging because it's mobile. You have to feed into the compact systems. And in those cases, it turns out people are looking at the various options, but say the mechanical way of converting those energy into electricity is not very feasible. So there are a lot of companies looking into thermoelectric, for example. And now you look at another way that we use energy is buildings. And give an example, in New England, in the winter, all home furnace, boilers, most of the time they are on. Well, very often they are on, right? And those are combustion process, and I end what we use it for. Hot shower, heat up the room, right? That's a low quality heat source. Once you quench to this temperature, you have high temperature combustion, you quench to low temperature, just take a shower, and you are generating a lot of entropy. And in some regions, there are big coal-fired power plant or oil-fired power plant, right? In this case, the people take this steam and supply the heat to the community. That's electricity heat, coal generation, cogen plant, right? But we don't do this at home. The technology is not out there yet. People are pushing, and in fact, there is a Honda is trying, for example, developing home standalone internal combustion based system. But it's not still not taking advantage during the combustion, during the heat up the hot water process. We are really generating a lot of entropy. We are wasting useful energy. So we develop technologies that can do home cogeneration. Industrial process, right? That's about another third of the energy that's used. And there are heat sources of different temperature, worldwide temperature range. Once I visited an aluminum smelting plant, so that's just converting aluminum oxide into aluminum. And the process is a high temperature electrochemical process. So you heat up aluminum oxide to melting state, and then you use an electrochemical way to extract the aluminum. And those plants are typically built just beside power plants, electrical power plants. The plant that I visited is a 500 megawatt electrical input. Okay. That's a huge power generation, say power requirement. Just give an example of how much is a 500 megawatt. A typical power plant is about a 1 gigawatt. And the world solar installation, solar photovoltaic installation, it's about 6 gigawatts now. So one power plant, one aluminum smelting plant takes 500 megawatts. And of course, there is part of this aluminum oxide to aluminum energy stored as chemical energy, but half of this is dumped into the environment as heat. Right? And right now there's no technology to really recoup this heat into anything useful. So now you think about this is a waste heat, right? Renewables. When we think of the photovoltaic, solar, we often think about photovoltaic. But fundamentally, solar is a high temperature heat source. Anyone knows the equivalent temperature of the solar radiation coming toward?
5,000.
Close.
7,000.
It's about, 6,000 Kelvin, 5,800. Okay? And geothermal. Those are renewable. Those are heat sources. Right? So, how we can we use as a heat. And in fact, if you look at how people, what the people are doing now, the solar utilization, the biggest installation is in solar water, not in PV, just hot water. And I came from China. When I grew up, there was no hot water, so I didn't seldom take a shower, no water in the winter. And nowadays, when I go back home, we have solar hot water. And it was a really fundamental life-changing technology, very cheap, but it's actually high-tech. So here I'm showing the solar hot water system that's widely used in China, and order of magnitude is about a 100 million square meter installation. 100 million square meter. And if you take 100 million square meter, you take a solar energy, 1 square meter is about 1 kilowatt. And a thermal efficiency, they collect the heat around 60%. So you multiply this together, how much you get? You get about 60 gigawatt, right? Thermal energy being used. And I said as a high tech, this is a evacuated tube, vacuum tube, okay? And so there's an inner layer, an outer layer, and in between is a vacuum tube. And then in the inner layer tube, there's a coating. this coating will absorb the solar radiation, but it minimize the thermal radiation. And it's done very cheaply. In a typical tube like this high, is only, I visited once at a factory, $1.5 tube, this big, all manufactured. So because of the really the low cost, it's widely used in developing countries. And of course, when you talk about the electrical generation, this is their installation in U.S. Kramer Junction, where the heat is from the sun is focused through those parabolic tubes, heat up the fluids, and these fluids are used to drive steam turbines. And there are also the power system that people are developing. Some are used in Spain and I think also Australia, where the mirrors focus and heat up the power here, and this goes to higher temperature. And the conversion is via mechanical systems. And the question, of course, so here, in this course, we're not, as I said, we're not looking into mechanical energy conversion. We're looking into alternatives. And I just want, so some of those alternatives that we're going to discuss, one is thermoelectric. In fact, Daniel, did that work?
Yeah.
If you can turn it on. So it's... you will see that this is a conversion that, as long as there's a temperature difference, it can generate electricity. It's bisonic. If you have used thermocouples, those are essentially thermocouples putting together. Right? Thermocouple, of course, we normally just want to generate the electrical signal, but in this case, you can also, if you make the equation, you will convert it into electricity. The second, so this is a, here, the working fluid is electron. And in this demo, what we have is just a copper, here is a heat source, right? Copper conduct heat to this side. The top side is hot. And there's a, this thermoelectric device, very thin, it's about 2 millimeter or 3 millimeter sandwiched between this copper and the heat sink, aluminum block. And hopefully I don't see it, but once the temperature difference, there's a temperature difference, you'll start see the LEDs lighting up. So that's direct no-moving parts, using electrons as working fluids. And the second example is the thermionic energy conversion. How many of you know that in our department there is the microfluidic Pascavalos lab? Pascavalos. That's on the second building three, second floor. Pascavalos was a professor in the mechanical engineering department, 1950s. And he developed this thermionic engine. So you can see it lighted up, right? And, of course, you have to maintain this temperature difference, so if we burn it for a long time, the other side, the cooling is not quite there. The temperature difference will be become small. Your power, I saw it before, it actually fluctuated before. But this is also another important aspect. It's a thermal system, so you have to put the heat in, take the heat out. And what the converter is small, but your thermal auxiliary system may be very big. So you have to do a good engineering design. Let's see, I was mentioning thermionic energy emission and energy conversion, and Professor Hastalos started his PhD on thermionic engines. And he spin off thermal electron. If you drive 128, you probably see that company. Thermal electron, now it's called thermal fissure. Right? And the original purpose was to develop the thermionic engines, In fact, you don't read it, it's 1956 or 58, I forgot. In the 1950s or 1960s, the efficiency was about 18% from heat like this. But it's very high temperature. So there are a lot of technological difficulties, and at the end, they didn't pursue in terms of commercialization. Of course, photovoltaic, normally we don't think of it as a heat engine, but it is a heat engine. It's limited by the second law of thermodynamics. Okay? And in fact, any time we can get close to second law, you'll be really happy. And but see, this is, of course, using the photon from the sun, and there's another way, is using the photon from a terrestrial heat source, right? You have a home furnace, and you can use the photon from there to do put a photovoltaic. That's called the thermal photovoltaic. So those are all ways, some of the direct energy conversion, non-moving parts here is using the charge as a fluid, and we'll be talking some of those technologies and the basic principles. And of course, when we think about the solar, the advantage, compare potential advantage, doesn't say it's demonstrated fully yet, is that in the case of photovoltaic, only the energy above the band gap of semiconductor is useful. But when you think about solar thermal, you can think about the full spectrum of the solar energy. So that's the, we started actually Department of Energy Center looking into how we can advance those technology. One is solar thermal photovoltaic. So here, the idea is I take the solar energy, I absorb it, but this is not directly onto photovoltaic cell, but I absorb it to heat up this and re-emit photon. Why you do that? Because when you re-emit the photon, if you can do better control, you can emit photon right at the band gap of the photovoltaic cell. And theory says you can potentially get a really high efficiency and with a single junction cell, but no demonstration. So that's one of the direction we're looking in this center. And the other direction is looking into thermoelectric, just like what we have here, the temperature difference instead of the burner here using the sun, anytime you have temperature difference. And again, the key is how we can make this efficient, how we can make that low cost. So when you think about energy, the cost is the main concern, right? The photovoltaic cost right now is just too high, so most people are reluctant to put onto their rooftop. So that's the motivations for this course. And to really understand those technology, we'll have to dive into, for some of us, for some of us, this may be unfamiliar territory, particularly, I think, for mechanical engineers, because most of the time, we are familiar with heat engines using steam, using molecules. And here, we're talking about heat engine using charge, electrons, and solid. So we'll have to cover some of the basic, the background knowledge in this area, and understand the technology, understand the limitation, and I want to bring you to the forefront of research. What are people doing? Maybe you have new ideas in doing new things. Now, just to make another comment, this is a very different, right? You can say the dying down process is slow. Thermal has the potential to do storage, right? With a thermal mass, you can store the energy. A photovoltaic, if there's no light, you really don't have any power there. So that's one potential advantage of thinking thermal. Okay, so now I'm going to move into really the first, what I want to use here is to reveal some thermodynamics and the heat transfer And if you have taken thermodynamics, if you ME, you will know some of the material. If you are from other department like physics, you also know some material. Both groups have some material maybe you're not familiar with. But my advice is just to take it. This is, I would say, this is my starting point for future discussions. So when we think about first law, the thermodynamics, we think about two laws. First law of thermodynamics, second law of thermodynamics. Right? We take a system, and we define, by define the boundaries, right? So the boundary define our system, and across the boundary, we have heat flow, we have work flow. A typical convention is that the, say, heat goes in, we take that positive, and work goes out, we take that as a positive. That's just due to convention. If you get a negative sign, means your heat goes out, or work goes in. And then we have closed system, means there's no mass flow across system boundary, or open system, when there's mass flow across system boundary. In the simplest form of thermodynamics, the first law is just the energy balance, right? On the left-hand side, I have the energy of the system, the energy change, and on the right-hand side is the heat transfer into the system minus the work output. Simple energy balance. You can write it into differential form, or you can write it into rate form. And then you do heat transfer, you actually use the rate form most often. But I say, some of you may still remember what's important is to recognize on the left-hand side is a state property that does not depend on the process. On the right-hand side is process-dependent. So it's actually very amazing. You take two process-dependent quantities, you take a difference, you get a quantity that's independent of the process. Looks very simple, but this is a truly important aspect. And the energy of the system, including kinetic energy, potential energy, and internal energy. Or if you have other forms of energy, like elastic, magnetic, all those. And consider relation that we're using is specific heat, for example. And here, the specific heat is the temperature derivative of the internal energy. Here, the internal energy, I use a small u. It could be either per unit mass based or per unit volume based. Okay, so that's the first law. Second law, we're written into an equation, but it's not an equation, it's an inequality. And what we have here is the entropy change. Again, this is a state property, entropy, equals the entropy transferred across the system boundary, and plus entropy generation in the system. Again, on the right-hand side, it's process-dependent, and on the left-hand side, it's our state properties. That's independent processes. Right? Now, I think about the heat engines. The heat engine, when we think about engine, we think about cyclic motion, right? You don't want the design engine only go one direction, doesn't come back. And so when we think about cyclic motion during a cycle, any state property, right, go back to the origin. It's an independent process. Once it goes back, the change is zero. So here we just wrote entropy and energy, any other state properties. So if entropy change is zero, now what's the maximum efficiency you can get? And maximum happens when there's no entropy generation. So if there's no entropy generation, SG is zero, and I look at this is my system, the heat in is positive, heat out is negative, so I have my second law written into left-hand side is zero, entropy generation zero, this entropy transfer across system boundary, right? And this gives me a relation between the heat in and heat out and temperature of the two reservoirs. And if I use this relation, I go to calculate what's, in this case, what's the efficiency of this heat engine. You can see the efficiency, of course, we define as the work we get versus the price you pay, that's the heat in. Okay? Efficiency here is the work. Now, the work first law tells you the work equals heat in minus heat out because the internal energy during a cycle change is zero, so you can see you got the power efficiency, right? That's the maximum you can get for any heat engines operating between two constant temperature thermal reservoirs. People sometimes look down into heat engines. So it's a heat engine. Meaning it's a thermally, you can't convert all the heat into electricity. That's correct, unless you have zero Kelvin, right? But the important thing is that you put in the lamper, and they see where we are. The heat engine is very respectful if you have even just a 200 degrees temperature heat source, and if you can get a common deficiency, 40%, right? You take the sun, 95%. Right? The more than thermal power plant is about 40%. I said that automobile internal combustion engines, right, the driving efficiency is less than 20%, and the IC engine efficiency is probably around 25%. So heat engine, if you can achieve the theoretical efficiency, you're doing really well. The problem is there are a lot of losses that limits us to get to practical, practically get too close to the power efficiency. Right? So that's the what you learned in 2005, thermodynamics. Now I want to go to a little bit microscopic picture. What's the entropy for that? And so let's look at an isolated system. Isolated means there's no heat transfer across system boundary, no work transfer, no mass transfer. It's isolated. But I'm going to look at, imagine I have the magic eye, I can look at the individual molecules, electrons in the system. Okay? And there are many different possible configurations. A molecule, the molecules in the system could be at different states, different position, and each atom could have many different possible energy states. This is from quantum mechanics, right? So every possible configuration, possibility, you can go back and take a two different color beads and mix them up. That's your experiment on this micro picture. And every possible configuration is a microstate. And let's suppose we know how to count the, what's the total number of those possible configurations. So the total number, that's omega microstate. Those are very big numbers. Okay? Now, what the basic principle of this microscope picture says, every state is equally possible, equal rights. Okay, no discrimination. And this is the equal probability principle. Every microstate is equally possible. And it's based on this, all this statistical description of the statistical thermodynamics is based on, starting from here. And what Boltzmann did is to relate this number of total microstates to Interpol. This was actually in Boltzmann's tombstone. You go to Vienna. And this KB is the Boltzmann constant, 1.3. I don't remember any. There are people in physics, they use atomic units. I always remember things in SI unit. So that's a difficult large exponent, 10 to the minus third joule per kelvin. But it's good to keep some numbers in mind, okay? So that's the, like I said, a starting point for the microscopic description. And here we're considering an isolated system. And now if you think about a not isolated system, a system that can thermally talk, exchange energy with the environment. And because of that, each microstate is no longer have equal right in terms of observation. The probability of this system, if you can observe this system in certain specific microstate that has certain energy E, and in this case, it's no longer equal probability. And we're not going to derivation, but you can go from here, equal probability, to construct an isolated system that made of your system and the environment. And with all that derivation, at the end, we get the probability of the system actually in one microstate. This is the one microstate that has energy E is depending on the temperature of the system and the energy here, exponential. Right? So you can say higher energy, less probable. And if you do chemical combustion or a lot of Arrhenius law, you probably learn in high school, right? That's this exponent. That's coming from here. Boltzmann statistics. And so here is a closed system. What if there is a mass flow, particle flow across system boundary? And in that case, this is similar, but there is an extra chemical potential uphill in the exponent. And this is a, say, constant temperature but open system. And mu here is a chemical potential. What is chemical potential? Think about temperature. Temperature is a driving force for heat flow. Chemical potential is the driving force for mass diffusion, mass flow. Okay? Pressure is the driving force for mechanical motion. Those are all thermodynamic, intrinsic thermodynamic quantities. Pressure, chemical potential, temperature. The other way to think about the chemical potential is it's the average energy needed to add particle into a system or take a particle out of the system. So first, chemical potential is the energy. Look at this. It's the equivalent here. And second, it's the driving force for the mass transfer. So if you do, chemistry, you do mass diffusion, or you do batteries, this is a quantity you would be dealing with all the time. Okay, so this is a microscopic, and now I'm going to apply what I just wrote down in the previous slide to molecules. Right? I have box of molecules, and I have equilibrium. Temperature T. I take one molecule, it has a kinetic energy. I'm thinking about the simple kinetic energy of the molecule. Right? So it's 1/2 mv². Of that v molecule is say velocity is the three components, the vx squared, vy squared, vz squared. So that's what I have there. And this is the energy. Remember in the previous slides, we say this is now a constant temperature molecule in thermal equilibrium at constant temperature. So that's the statistical closed system I'm using. Okay? And this is the energy, that's a kinetic energy. And here is a probability, right? Probability, I have a normalization factor. So I put in the probability of this molecule having the velocity Vx, Vy, Vz. And the next step, I want to determine A. Determine that prefactor A. Right? What I do. The probability, so the molecule probability is the velocity is from minus infinite to plus infinite. I include every possible chance. Right? So if I include every possible chance, that's my normal, the way I find out this factor A, that's all the, say, velocity from negative infinite to positive infinite, and this should sum up to what? We got to have the velocity in between this. And if you do this integration, you find your factor A. And this is the famous Maxwell distribution for molecules.
It should be a minus.
Oh, thank you. Yes. There is a minus. There is this minus sign here. Thank you.
Let's see the other one. Yeah.
Yes. Please add a minus sign. And here is the same problem. I just copied it. Now, if it's a probability, once you have probability, you can calculate your observation, right? What's the average once you have probability? So I want to find that the average energy, kinetic translational energy, motion, kinetic energy of this molecule. So here is the energy weighed by this probability over all possible velocities. Right? And again, it's an integration. You either can do yourself or you look at a table. And what you find out is a very simple result. E equals 3/2 kBT. Okay? Boltzmann constant. It's 3/2 kBT, actually, is a very good number to remember, kBT. But also, is a fundamental, there is a fundamental principle, equal partition principle, which says if your microscopic energy is quadratic, so if you look at this, kinetic energy is quadratic is in velocity, mv squared, right? So if energy is quadratic, each of this quadratic term contribute average energy half kBT. So if you look at this molecule there, because it has three quadratic terms, so each contribute 1/2 kBT, and total gets retained 1/2 kBT. So that's the, this is the equal partition principle. And now I would like you to get an idea of what is kBT. This is a really something that if you want to have a microscopic mind, you should remember. How large is it? KBT, 1.3 10 to the minus 23rd, 300 degree Kelvin. I think I forgot to correct this again. No, this should be 4, not 5. 4.14, right? 4.14, and if you take a 4.14 divided by 4, that's a big number, so hard to remember. And people, again, different field, people use different ways, different measures, and one often used unit is the electron volt as an energy unit. What is the electron volt? You have a charge, you apply an electric field, 1 volt, say under 1 volt, electric potential, how much energy it has. So one electron volt is 1.6 10 to the minus 19 joules. So I translate this into at room temperature, 1 kBT is 26 milli electron volts. Okay? Now, think about if this is the average energy of the molecule, how fast they are moving? This is the molecule moving in this room. You can go to estimate right? Because this energy equals 1/2 mv squared. So you can go to estimate the energy, the velocity of the molecule, 1/2 cancel, you do the mass. I took the oxygen as an example. I know the number of say oxygen atomic number is 8, so it's 16 neutron proton, and each of the proton mass is 1.67 times mass 27. So number is about 200 meters per second. Depends on whether it's a light molecule, heavy molecules. So those are the microscopic molecular picture there. Right. That's about molecules. Let's think about the electrons. Molecule there, what do we say? We did not do anything quantum side. Maxwell distribution is a classical statistical thermodynamics. Now, when I do electrons, the quantum mechanics sometimes is very important, so I have to think more quantum picture. From quantum mechanics, we learn, you have physics before, basic idea, I'm sure you all heard about, energy levels are quantized, right? And this is some of you may still remember, if you have a quantum mechanical state, you can only have one electron, right? Pauli exclusion principle. And the quantum mechanics actually, here I listed Planck-Einstein relation that gives the energy. This actually started from a photon, so next slide I have more energy related to the frequency of the photon and the momentum related to wavelength of the photon. So that's the so-called Planck-Einstein relation. And what's in, again, this is another number. If you think about the quantum, you'll always see H Planck constant at 6.6 10 to the minus 34 joule. Okay, so now I'm going to look at one quantum mechanical state. And this quantum mechanical state can have a maximum of one electron, right? You could have zero electron, you could have one electron. And this quantum state has energy E, quantum mechanically allowable energy. When the electron is there, this state has energy E. When it's empty, no electron, the actual energy of the system is zero, right? But I only can have two possibilities. So I have these two possibilities. I sum this up. I want to find this A. The difference between the molecule I did before and here, for molecule velocity, I say, okay, from minus infinity to plus infinity, I include everything. But for the electron here, I only have zero electron or one electron. So I sum this up to one, I will find A. I'm not going to leave the detailed math. So from the previous relation, I found A, and now I give you average. Again, I can give you the average energy, because if I do observation, it's zero or it's E. And if I do a lot of observation, it's an equilibrium state, say at temperature T, what's the average time, average energy, or average number of electrons? Right? Each individual observation could be zero or one, but there is an average possibility, right? So if I look at that average, again, say this is an N, could be zero or one, and you sum up to Fermi-Dirac distribution. This is you look at that, what's the range of this F, the average? Zero to one. That's the, you can't be above one, because maximum is one, minimum zero, so it's between zero and one. And then you plot those, depends on the temperature, right? And it depends on whether the energy of this level is above the chemical potential or below the chemical potential. The chemical potential is the, say, we said before, now it's you can think of this one quantum state that the open system, the electron can come in and goes out. The chemical potential is what's the average energy you need to take the electron in or put the electron. Take the electron out, put the electron. Right? So, depends on whether it's above or below, you can say it's close to 1 or close to 0. Very narrowly distributed near the chemical potential. And in fact, if your temperature is 0, this will be a sharp transition at the chemical potential. Above is 1, and here below, let's say, above is 0 and below is 1. And the chemical potential at zero temperature, there's a special lane people give, often they call that Fermi level. But in a lot of different fields, sometimes people just call Fermi level for any temperature. So it's terminology convention. Okay, so that's for electron. Now we're going to lecture two. We talk about molecule. Talk about electron. Next, I'm going to talk about electromagnetic wave, the photons. Right? I mentioned before the Planck-Einstein relationship is really looking into photon, and later on was generalized for any material wave. And so what we have is if there is electromagnetic wave at a certain frequency mu. What the Planck found is that the energy of that mode, the quantum mechanical state, at the time there was no quantum mechanics, so electromagnetic mode, of specific mode, the energy has to be quantized, and basic energy quanta is H nu. And this energy quanta later on was called a photon. And what Einstein came in is saying that the quanta not only just say they have the wave, but also has a momentum. So this is where the wave particle duality came from. So the momentum of the quanta is related to the wavelength of the wave, and again related via H. And so the each quantum state, the energy can only be a multiple of that H nu. Normally, when we think about the wave continuum mechanics, it can be any value. But the quantum difference is that the energy could be only multiple, so n is now integer, and it has one half, that's also called this one half. Normally, it's not important, it's called zero-point energy. And there's really, if you still recall some quantum mechanics, that's the so-called Heisenberg uncertainty principle requirement. So this is zero-point energy. Normally it's not important, so I'm not going to detail much. So that's a full. Okay, now I'm going to, it turns out the whole photon, you can think of this as the electromagnetic wave. Now I'm going to talk about a different wave. That's the lattice wave, the atomic vibration. Right? The atomic vibration, now you can think about, started with classical mechanics. If you have mass spring system, the fundamental natural frequency is square root of k over m. Right? And of course, in classical mechanics, we say the energy is related to the amplitude of the wave, the velocity. And once you go to quantum, it turns out this wave, the energy cannot be any value, same as the electromagnetic wave. And the energy can only be multiples, same, you can say, multiples of H nu. And now there was an analogy made for this quanta of vibration. That analogy is Fourier. Okay? electromagnetic wave, the phase energy quanta is a photon. That is atomic vibrational. The energy, base energy quanta is photon. Okay. So what's the statistic they obey, right? At a certain quantum state, if you think about electron, could be zero and one. Maximum is one. And here, at the mode, at less frequency, it could be zero, one, two, infinite. So that's the difference. Electron, zero, one. And here I could be any number, integer number. So I need to find the distribution, the average number of photon or photon if I have a equilibrium system. Okay? Do the same thing. Right? I have the probability, and now if I have n photon or photon in this micro state, the quantum mechanical state that has this specific frequency, that's the probability. I sum this up from n equals 0 to infinite. That still should give me 1, right? You have either 0 or 1 or infinite number, or the in between, somewhere in between. So sum up, I have 1, I will determine A. And this A, from this A, I go to find the average again. And once I find the probability, I find the average number, right? Same way as I did for electron. And this average number now is the Bose-Einstein distribution. And this Bose-Einstein distribution, if you compare with the previous Fermi-Dirac distribution, the only thing changed is the plus sign now goes to minus sign. And because of that, it's no longer between 0 to 1, it's between 0 to infinite. Right? And in fact, for photon and photon, because the number is not conserved, okay? It's not like an electron, it's a conserved number. So temporal potential concept is not called, is not a good one. So that's a 0, we think of the 0. And this is the distribution of Bose-Einstein distribution.
What's the reason for setting mu at 0?
It's not a conserved quantity. It's, when we talk about mass transfer particle, that's a fixed number, right? Total number, either going out or going in. But that's a conserved number. Here is not a conserved number. But there, actually, see, later on, when we talk about the solar cell, you'll find out there is a quasi Fermi level getting into you here. So it's actually a very deep thing there. This is just a simple argument. Okay. And that's about it. Now, in this time frame, like I said, you're probably familiar with the classical thermodynamic. You're not familiar with the statistical side. Like, you just take it. Okay, this is how the result will be using. What gets into your mind, microscopically, we have Boltzmann distribution. We have Fermi-Dirac distribution for electron. We have Bose-Einstein distribution for photon. That's what you need to know. Okay. And what we need, I'm going to summarize next. This is the heat transfer. Before was thermodynamics. Now, heat transfer, again, you take 2005, 2006, this is a very, should be, very familiar. If I have, we have three modes of heat transfer, right? Conduction, convection, and radiation. And describing the conduction is a Fourier law of diffusion. So the heat transfer rate, here I put the rate in watt, it's proportional to the area, proportional to temperature gradient, and proportionality constant is the thermal conductivity. And that's a material property. Normally, we think of it as a material property. And the negative sign actually take care of the second law. It says temperature, heat will flow from high temperature to low temperature. And you can do, that's from watt, you can do flux, that's per unit area based. So just normalize the area, or you try generalize it into three dimension rather than write it into one dimension. So that's heat conduction. And convection is when you have fluid flow in the surrounding of a heated or cold surface, the heat transfer between the surface and the fluid is proportional to the temperature difference of the wall and the fluid. This fluid is actually transition. The temperature goes from the wall to gradually to the center of the fluid or ambient. Right? And the proportionality constant here is H, the heat transfer coefficient. And but H is a flow dependent. It's not a mature property. Depends on how fast the fluid flow, and depends on the geometry. So this is a big topic in 2005, 2006, and we know there is natural convection, forced convection. So this is just in terms of the terminology. So those are conduction and convection. And of course, the third mode of heat transfer is the radiation, thermal radiation. Right? Thermal radiation for black body, one single surface or black object, the emission is given by the Stefan-Boltzmann law as the proportional to temperature force power. The proportionality constant is Stefan-Boltzmann constant, right? So this is for black object. The real object is not black, so we use the emissivity to characterize it, and we'll discuss some more down the road. Now, if I have two objects exchange heat, in this case, it could be vacuum, right? That's the difference of radiation compared to conduction and convection, which requires a media, and here the heat transfer is by electromagnetic waves. So I wrote a simple form of radiation. The left heat transfer is the temperature force power. And remember here you have to use the Kelvin, not degree Celsius. Look at the units and so in Kelvin. And if the object is not black, we use the emissivity. And here is the effective between two surfaces, because the two surfaces may be different. Like I said, we'll discuss more down the road. So those are three modes of heat transfer. Right? And in this course, we'll talk more on conduction, we'll talk more on radiation. You have learned a lot, some of you learned a lot of convection, so that's probably fair, right? Now let's think a little bit more on conduction. If I have a one-dimensional null heat generation inside, the heat flow is constant, so Q is constant. You go back to the Fourier law, you integrate it, you find out the heat transfer between the two points from this to the other side at steady state is proportional to thermal conductivity, temperature, area, inverse proportional to the length. So if you want to do thermal isolation, what do? You use a long object, use a smaller cross-section, right? That's a thermal isolation. A lot of times when you design a thermal system, not only in heat getting in, you also want to isolate it. And the R, we can combine all this right into thermal resistance, not just a definition, because this way it looks very similar to electrical circuit where your driving voltage is now the temperature difference and your current is a heat current and your resistance. So you can use the same way as you do circuit analysis. If you know the thermal resistance, this is for different geometries different, and even for convection, you can express, you go to do thermal resistance. So So you can build a thermal resistor network to do some simple heat transfer. Okay. And another thing that's important to keep in mind is the order of magnitude. What are the good conductors? What are good insulators? Right? And the best conductor turns out is diamond. Why? That's because the bumping, the spring. So in this case, it is the wave, atomic wave that carries the heat. So if the bumping between the atoms is strong, the spring constant is large, the velocity is large. So that's why diamond is a good conductor. And metals are not that good. Metals are by electrons. And the insulators, so you can say the wood, amorphous material, quartz, those are poor thermal conductors. Because the atomic arrangement is random, and the randomness make the wave harder to propagate in the material. Okay. So this is, again, macroscopic. Now I'm going to also give you the other view, microscopic view of heat transfer. And the kinetic picture. So what happens, how heat really is conducted. Let's think about the molecules. And the molecules, let's say we have a box, and one side is hot, the other side is cold. Let's forget about convection. How heat goes from one hot side, via the molecule, to the cold side. It's really on the hot side, the air molecule, right, collides with the wall. And on the wall is hot, means the velocity is faster. So this molecule will get, say, faster velocity due to that energy change between the wall and the air molecule. Now, this hotter air molecule will collide with the labored molecule. Of course, they have a chance to go randomly. Every molecule is moving a few hundred meters per second, as we talked before, right? And they collide with the cooler one, and they impart some of that excess energy to the next labor. The next labor go back and forth. Again, they do this cascade energy from the hot to the cold side. It's a diffusion process. And typically, there is the distance of this collision, right? You can go to estimate it, and then turns out that this distance between the average molecule collision is about 100 nanometer. In this room, the air molecule distance between collision is about 100 nanometer. Okay? And so now I gave you a few more definition. Right, the energy per particle, let's again take energy per particle as E, and the average velocity is V, and time between collision is tau, and distance between collision is gamma, that's a mean free cost. So time is the average time between collision is relaxation time. And this distance and the time is related by the velocity. Right? So, what is a heat transfer? When I think about heat going through this imaginary surface here, how I calculate it? I do counting. I will say, okay, only those molecules within 1 mean free pass, Vx is the velocity component in the x direction, times the collision time, right? So only those molecules can go zip through the interface without collision. Because tau is the average time between collision. So this part of the molecule is hotter, they go from this side to the other side. And on this side, the molecule is cooler. Again, in the Vx times tau, that range, they go from this side to the other side. Right? And I take the difference. I count all the molecules. I take the difference, that's my heat flux. So let me write down the math. That's what I do. I say, on the left-hand side, this is a per unit volume of how many? N is the particle number density, I forgot, the first, the second bullet there. Each particle how much energy has, and this is the velocity in the x direction, right? So I say only in this range from x to vx minus tau, in this range you can go through, on the other side is x plus vx tau. You can do more detail, but clearly this is a very simple argument, right? So that gives me local heat flux. You go check a unit, is a watt per meter square heat flux. And then lastly, just do Taylor expansion of these two terms and write it into a differential form, because this is about 100 nanometer. If I do meters or centimeter or millimeters, that's essentially a continuum, right? Very small delta. So I do the derivative, and I do Taylor expansion. This one half is because there's only half of this go this way, half go that way, right? So that's where the half came from. And after I do the Taylor expansion, I have E and V, and Vx. Vx is random velocity. I pull out, it's independent of distance. It could be dependent on this, I'm just making an assumption, approximation. Indian not different distance, this is Vx squared. Vx squared is a random, so it's one-third of the average velocity. One-third of V squared. So that's my one-third of V squared, replacing this Vx squared. Tau is here, and the N times E is per unit volume, how much energy, internal energy the molecule has, right? So I have this N times E is U, and I take a chain rule du dt dt dx. Okay, what do you get? You get Fourier law. Right? Because here is one third V squared, tau, C, and that's the thermal conductivity, and this is temperature gradient. You can do that. You can go back and do your Fick's law, and Newton shear stress law, in fact, all the diffusion law you learn in three steps.
But
yes?
You said we could move the velocity out of the derivative because it was constant.
Right.
But isn't the velocity related to the temperature?
Yeah, good question. This is later on when I discuss the thermoelectric effect, I'll come back to this. Okay. Here I'm talking about molecule, and I just wanted to show you the Fourier law. They're clearly approximation, and what you're talking is more like a coupled mass and heat transfer. And in fact, if you learn once the heat transfer, you know mass and heat transfer couples. Okay, so the thermal conductivity is one third specific heat. Velocity and mean free pass. Okay? And the specific heat is per unit volume. If I do capital C, it's per unit volume based. And typically we do per unit mass based, so it's just density times per unit mass based. Okay? So this is a very useful relation to keep in mind. Simple, the thermal conductivity depends on how many energy is stored by the molecule, how fast they travel, and how far they travel between collision. So if you want the high thermal conductivity, you want them to travel far. If you want low thermal conductivity, you reduce that. Right? And for most solid, this C is about 10 to the 6th power. It doesn't vary by a factor of 5. So when I do on my back of envelope order magnitude estimation, I say C is 10 to the 6th. You go to check. And velocity in solid is just so you can roughly think of the speed of sound. A few hundred to a few thousand meters per second. The mean free pass is short, right? Nanometers, 100 nanometers. So that's the range order. Okay, so this is I figure most of you probably in 2005 you haven't seen it. It's a very simple, but the picture is really, the diffusion picture was similar. let me give you, I haven't at all finished. Relations, I come back to, I said that Stefan Boltzmann law, right? And what I want to show you next is how I can derive Stefan Boltzmann law from the statistics I just showed. So, I'm considering enclosure. Let me even imagine the enclosure is perfectly reflecting. There are photons and the walls is at the temperature T. So it's an equilibrium system. I want to see how many, the electromagnetic wave inside this box, how much energy they have at a constant temperature. Equilibrium, thermal equilibrium, right? So let's go back to a little bit of the basic relations of electromagnetic wave. We know the speed of light is a proportional. It's speed of light is the wavelength times frequency, right? That's high school we learned. And definition, I say angular velocity is 2 pi mu. Wave vector magnitude is 2 pi over lambda. What is the wave vector? The wave propagates in a certain direction, right? And so it's because the direction is a vector. 2 pi lambda. Lambda is a wavelength, it's a scalar, and the directionality gives the vector. So it's a kx, k by kz if you do Cartesian coordinate. And so I can write the c equals mu times lambda in terms of frequency and wave vector is c times omega equals ck. So this relation between wave vector magnitude and the frequency is called dispersion. And then in the case of light, it's a linear, right? C is 3 × 10⁸ meter per second. And of course, because of vector, so it's a square root of the components. So that's the dispersion. And now I want to count. My question is how much energy photon has inside this box, right? I'm going to count how many modes it has. Remember, each mode, the Bose-Einstein distribution already tells me each mode how many photons. So, how many modes? So that's basically I'm counting, right? A mode, because I'm a perfect wall, so you can see the mode has to be standing wave here. Either this way or this way, that is boundary, it's zero.
Why is it zero?
Huh?
Why should it be zero?
Otherwise, it doesn't get a steady state. It keeps propagating. Okay? So, this is my wavelength component in the x direction. Kx, right, is a corresponding wavelength in kx direction. And the Lx is the length here, right? So if I just say this must satisfy the rule, then I have to have integer. Those are the possibilities. And that could translate in the possibility of my k. Kx is just 2 pi over lambda x. So this is n tau pi 2 Lx. Okay. So each combination of nx, ny, nz, each set gives me one mole. And when I want to find out how much energy, I just sum up all those modes, right? So I sum that up. And remember, when I do molecules, I do velocity from minus infinite to plus infinite. And here, when I do this, I do discrete summation of nx, ny, nz, right? So I do this summation. This is nx, ny, nz. Each mode has, this is the number of photon in this every set, and this is the energy of a photon is h omega. I got a factor of 2 because the electromagnetic wave is transverse wave, and it has two polarizations. So that factor of 2 comes what it comes from. Okay. If you don't look at this, that's where my starting point. And what I want to do is, rather than do the summation, I'm going to translate it into integration. Summation is over n. So if you look at this, the interval between n and k is 2 pi 2 lx. So when I have a dkx, I divide by 2 pi 2 lx, that's n. If this is a large number, but small, you have a lot of problem. So I translate this summation in nx into this dkx integration. I do the same for ky, kz. This is what I'm just copying. I wrote the extra step here just for the later purpose, because my function is an even function, so I extend to minus infinite to plus infinite. The difference is a factor of 2, so I don't have this 2 here anymore, because the factor of 2 is gone. Okay, that's just for my later purpose. The end result, this is just equivalent. And what it means, I can, rather than standing wave, I can say do two counterpropagating. One goes left, one goes right. That's when you do the maximum velocity is minus infinite to plus infinite. So that's equivalent. Okay. I think I will probably have to stop here. There are two more slides you can look at, but I'll discuss what's coming is the black body radiation in each wavelength, how much energy carries. With simple this concept. Okay?